Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Today is Holocaust Remembrance Day, a day when we look back at one of the darkest periods in history. 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust, but the Nazis also targeted and killed others they found undesirable, gypsies and homosexuals. Today on Smart Talk, we discuss when Nazis came up with their final solution to the Jewish question in Europe. Our guests, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Ray Millen, a professor of security sector reform at the Peacekeeping and Stability Operations Institute, U.S. Army War College, the Carlisle Barracks. Dr. Millen, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Also joining us, and we'll hear her story in just a few minutes, Pamela Weinberg. She's a local author and educator whose parents survived the Holocaust. Ms. Weinberg, I'm glad to have you here today as well.
Well, thank you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Dr. Millen, I want to start with the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And some people may be confused because there is an International Holocaust Remembrance Day in January. But this is something that Congress enacted, President Carter signed back in the late 70s. And it is this date, not this exact date, but the time when Holocaust Remembrance Day is commemorated, has to do with the uprising, the Jewish uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, the Warsaw Ghetto is one of many ghettos that were in Poland and Germany and Czechoslovakia. The Jewish Poles in Warsaw had received enough information that they were that the ghetto was just a staging area, that the next stop would be a death camp. They had 8 death camps in that part of Europe. So we have a number of resistance movements inside the ghetto itself, and they rose up to attempt to stop the Germans from staging them elsewhere.
Why is Holocaust Remembrance Day tied to that?
Because it's part of the Holocaust. The Holocaust was a gigantic enterprise, and it begins with the Wannsee Conference. That's the final solution that occurs in January 1942. But it starts much earlier than that. It really starts once the Nazis come into power in 1933. They use sophisticated propaganda with the goal of characterizing the Jews as an alien race within Germany. And then the other portion of that propaganda was to either have the Germans hate Jews or to make them indifferent to the regime's persecution of the Jews. And we have a step-by-step process at that point. The next step is going to be the Nuremberg Laws, which are tied to blood. That categorized Jews as either full-blooded Jews, half, or quarter. And that determined your deportation. The initial plan was just to deport all the Jews out of Germany. It's only about 500,000 Jews that live in Germany at the time. That's less than 1%. So your average German probably didn't even know a Jew. And but the regime's goal was to purify the German community. That's the Volksgemeinschaft. And by doing so, they would have a pure Germany, not only purified of Jews, but also homosexuals, political dissidents, and the like. So after the Nuremberg Laws, then we jump to Kristallnacht, which happens on 9 November. That's not a coincidence. 9 November is when Germany signed the armistice in World War I. So the Nazis would always use this date for big events for the regime's program. After Kristallnacht, which results in the destruction of hundreds of synagogues, thousands of homes and businesses were destroyed. A day or so later, 30,000 male Jews are arrested and sent to 3 concentration camps. This begins the process. And so by the beginning of the war, half of the Jews in Germany had been deported to the East.
I wanted to focus today on the Wannsee Conference. This is not something that is very well known Probably most historians it is. But if you ask a lot of people about the Holocaust and you mention the Wannsee Conference, probably the majority of them don't know what it is. You mentioned it. What is it?
Okay, so the Wannsee Conference was held on 20 January 1942. It was the participants were high-level Nazi functionaries, but they were not the top tier. Hitler, Goering, and Himmler had to have plausible deniability. So it was really sponsored by Reinhard Heydrich, who is the second in command of the SS, and with a number of other functionaries. And so they decide that we have a Jewish problem. Now that we've acquired all this new territory as a result of the war, we have to decide what to do. And that became the final solution. So it went from deportation to wholesale eradication of the Jews.
Talk about that a little bit more.
Okay.
What was the final solution?
Okay. So the final solution was the slaughter of all Jews in Europe. There's 11 million Jews that are living in occupied Europe at the time, German-occupied Europe. So they had a problem of what to do with them all. You have to feed them. This takes away from the war effort. So they decide that the best way is to send them to death camps. There were 8 death camps, and there were thousands of labor camps. If you were Jewish, it made no difference whether you were on a labor camp or a death camp. It's just a matter of time when you would die. So they used the transportation network, the railways, to transport Jews to satellite camps, to ghettos, and to labor camps, and then finally to the death camp. So it was a gigantic conveyor belt type of operation.
And something you just said that today, 70-some years later, we look at it and don't realize probably that Hitler was even thinking along these lines. Plausible deniability. Don't think about that with Hitler. I mean, it appears, again, looking back 70 years, that it didn't matter. That, you know, he talked about how the Jews were such a problem in Germany and in Europe that why would he want to even deny it? War crimes?
Well, no, it wasn't due to the war crimes. It was that Hitler was thinking ahead and his legacy. And so he cannot be tied to this, a very difficult thing to do. Hitler and Himmler forgive the German people for things that they're going to have to do. Strong Germans would execute these programs. Ironically, you have a number of German soldiers that refuse to participate in the atrocities. They're having psychological problems. And this is with the death squads that are rampaging through Ukraine, the Baltics, and Poland. And a lot of them are having nervous breakdowns or just refusing to shoot Jews and other prisoners. So the regime decides that the way to impersonalize the process is by using gas chambers. The German guards would herd them into the showers and be gassed, but it would be the trustees or Jewish inmates that would take the bodies out for cremation.
Again, we think of Hitler's legacy today. He was actually thinking ahead, thinking he would have a positive legacy?
Well, he was going to win the war, so of course.
And he'd be a superstar.
It would be important that they got rid of a problem that no one in Europe really wanted. They did not want to have Jews in Europe. Anti-Semitism was centuries old. Not to the point of killing them. Hatred was good enough.
So getting back to Wannsee, understand that there are not a lot of records of this conference.
There was only one surviving record of the conference. Heydrich has said that all the records would be destroyed and there would be no mention of it. Fortunately for us, one person maintained a copy of the records. That's how we know about it. And we uncovered those records at the end of the war.
So maybe that's one of the reasons that not a lot of people know about this.
Right. Now, there was a movie called Conspiracy, and that's
on HBO, right?
Right. Kenneth Branagh, Stanley Tucci, plays Adolf Eichmann, who's in charge of the transportation plan. This movie is really well done, but you have to have a background to understand what's going on and what's being discussed.
There were 15 high-ranking Nazis and other government leaders there at Wannsee. Were all 15 on board with this?
Some had to be talked into it. The interior minister took a legal aspect of the solution, the final solution. He wanted it to be codified into law. That's what they'd done before. That's where the Nuremberg laws are so important. And so, by having a law, everything is legal. So if you're going to murder all the Jews, it had to have a legal aspect to it. Now, Heydrich tells him that the Führer is not going to sign something into law because he has to have plausible deniability, and he'll also continue to deny that he had any knowledge of this. So this is part of it.
You say that some had to be talked into it, and you just mentioned that at least one was for legal reasons. How about moral reasons? I mean, was there anyone there who objected, saying this isn't right?
There is one minister, I forget his name, I think it might have been Fisher, but I'm not positive, who did not want to take that final step. It's okay to hate, it's okay to deport, but to take that step and kill them, he wasn't on board with that. So Heydrich actually had to take him to the side and say, look, I need your assistance in this, and I need your help to reach consensus with everybody else. You're a powerful person, but that doesn't mean that you don't have weaknesses. So I will target you afterwards if I have to. So that's when the minister comes on board. Although he feels very guilty about it after the war, he says, I think he's at the Nuremberg trials, he says, I bear guilt into this, and I'm totally ashamed that I bought into it. So,
how did he end up at Nuremberg?
Everyone that was involved with crimes against humanity and war crimes went through the Nuremberg and the Dachau process.
But I mean, what was his sentence?
There is no justice here. All right, a lot of these functionaries were acquitted simply because there was not enough evidence to tie them to the final solution. So they may have served a couple of years, but most of them died very old men in Germany.
So as I mentioned what you do today, Professor of Security, Sector Reform at Peacekeeping and Stability Operations Institute. Why do you study the Holocaust?
Well, I was first tasked, so to speak, a few years ago to come up with a program for Holocaust Remembrance Day. And so I did my research, found the film Conspiracy, and also invited a guest speaker in to talk about genocide and things like that.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. It is Holocaust Remembrance Day. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Pamela Weinberg is a local author and educator. Her parents survived the Holocaust. Ms. Weinberg, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Were your parents living at the time that the war began?
My father was living in Karlsruhe, Germany, and my mother was living in Vienna, Austria.
So they were, your father especially, was a German Jew.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What was happening that led your grandparents to make the decision to send your mother, first of all, I should ask what this is. She went on the Kinder Transport. What is the Kinder Transport?
The Kinder Transport was a group of organizations that were rescuing children, and the children were deported. They were in a group, but they were not with their parents at all. These were just the children, and they went by train. My mother in particular went by train from Vienna and to ended up in London mm-hmm. via Holland.
And your mother did settle in England, right?
No, my mother was a 15-year-old.
Okay.
And she was sponsored by a family, so basically it was foster care. And she was fortunate enough because she was only there for 1.5 years, but her parents were in America. They were also sponsored by another family, of course, in a different venue.
So what was happening that led your grandparents to make the decision to send your mother on the kinder transport?
Well, they were able to see the peril that was coming.
In other words, writing was on the wall.
Yes.
In what ways? I mean, have you heard stories of why they were able to see what was coming?
Well, it came on gradually, and my mother remembers being sent to the back of the room in her school years. And then finally, they were not able to have an education. So, and she couldn't have a bicycle. And it just, little by little, they were able to see.
Not able to have a bicycle.
So they wouldn't be able to have transportation.
Not like a lot of American kids think of using a bicycle just for fun.
Right.
In Europe, and still is the case, where bicycles are a very important part of transportation.
Yes.
But so there were Jews that were limited and, I don't know, barred from having bicycles?
Well, from public transportation, but this is as a child.
Right.
So mm-hmm. I'm remembering the stories my mother told me. And she was saying how to her it was an adventure to go as a 15-year-old to a foreign country. Now, fortunately, she was well-educated, so she knew English. She could read and she could write, and she was able to speak English poorly, as she would say, but I thought it was very well by the time I knew her. And so her experience was, again, as an adventure. Well, for her parents, though, the sacrifice and the courage to be able to send your child to a foreign country and not know if you'd ever see them again.
So what did your parents say about the Holocaust?
My parents at the time, the culture for immigrants and refugees was to be very quiet about it, to assimilate yourself to American living, and they wanted their children to have the best of American life. You know, they wanted the American dream. Be well educated. They wanted to have a home, and they had friends and family and work. And that was what the focus was, not on the Holocaust and not on all the terrible things that had happened to their families.
But did it shape their lives?
Oh, it absolutely shaped their lives.
In what way?
They were so convinced that the family was so central to protect your children, to, even though the world is not trustworthy, that you wanted your children to have trust in strangers, but still be vigilant. So I was very protected as a child because of that, because so many family members had been lost and had been murdered.
Your family, your father's family in Germany, did they survive the war?
Yes, they did. I was very fortunate because I actually had 4 grandparents, which is unusual for coming from the Holocaust. So many families were lost. I mean, obviously, millions and millions.
But I also understand a lot of your cousins, most of your cousins.
My mother had 40 first cousins, and after the war, there were 8 first cousins, and their families had been lost.
Mm. Why do you think it's important that we commemorate the Holocaust?
Especially in today's political climate and with what is happening in terms of genocide and war, you know, we should remember that this did happen. It occurred. And starting from the historical perspective, when it is, you know, the moral compass is missing from people and from a country, I think it's critical that we remember to keep our own moral compass.
Mm. I want to thank you both for being here today. I wish we had more time, and maybe in the future we can do this again. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. It is, it's spring, as you will find out today, starting today and going through the weekend, where we have some actual spring-like temperatures. But it also is a WITF spring fundraising campaign. And WITF's multimedia news director Tim Lambert is here.
That's right, Scott. It's the next to last day of our spring fundraising campaign. We have a goal of $1,500 to reach by 10 o'clock for Smart Talk today. And we had a nice run on Morning Edition, but we want to keep that momentum going as we look to reach that overall goal of $75,000 by 6:30 p.m. tomorrow. And if you enjoy Smart Talk, if you just heard the wonderful conversation we heard on Smart Talk, make a contribution now at WITF.org or call 1-800-233-9483. There's an article in the New York Times today about the number of people who don't even know the Holocaust existed, which is a staggering amount. It was like 41% in this country. And events like today are an example of how to keep that history alive.
Tim, you know, I know that WITF listeners, our loyal audience, that history is one of the topics that they are most interested in. And we try to do that. And really, I don't know, I try to think of other radio stations where you can hear a discussion about the Holocaust. And I can't come up with any. That is something that is unique to WITF, at least here in Central Pennsylvania.
Yeah, the one that will devote 25 minutes to the to that topic and really delve into it, as you just did in the last segment. So if that's the kind of conversation that you want each and every day, make that contribution now. It could be a $5 a month contribution, a $10 a month contribution, a dollar a day contribution, or a one day, an annual contribution, or a 1 year contribution of $365, maybe $100 a month. Whatever you think is worth your investment in what we do each and every day, make that contribution at WITF.org. Help us stay on track to reach that goal, $1,500 by 10 o'clock. Make that call now at 1-800-233-9483.
Tim, we'll talk to you again in just a few minutes, but I'll echo what Tim just had to say. Smart Talk listeners, come through. Let's hit that goal of $1,500. 1-800-233-9483 or go to smarttalk.org. Or excuse me, I'm giving more. I have so many websites here. Go to WITF.org/give now, and we'd like to hear from you. And please, support WITF, support Smart Talk, support all the programs here on WITF. Best-selling author Patrick Sharkey's latest book is entitled Uneasy Peace: The Great Crime Decline, The Renewal of City Life, and the Next War on Violence. It details the significant drop in crime over the last 30 years and what can be done to keep it from rising again. Patrick Sharkey appears at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg tonight at 7. I had the opportunity to sit down and talk with Patrick Sharkey earlier this week. Patrick Sharkey, welcome to Smart Talk.
Thanks for having me.
So how did this book come to be? Why did you write it?
I wrote it because I was doing a bunch of work, and it was really a different question. I was doing research on why growing up in a very poor, very disadvantaged neighborhood seems to be so harmful, so damaging for kids. And I was doing a lot of work on that question. And the more research I did, the more I started to see that violence might be the crucial piece of an answer. And so this was really just following the data, and I saw more and more evidence suggesting that the effects of violence were, everyone knows that violence is harmful, but the effects were just so much more severe than I had realized, certainly. And then I think that the evidence generated to that point suggested. So it was really I followed the data, and the data told me that violent crime might be the most important thing going on in very disadvantaged neighborhoods that really affects the trajectories of kids, that affects how they do in school, their cognitive development, and ultimately how they do in the labor force over time.
According to the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law, the national crime rate peaked in 1991. There were 716 violent crimes per 100,000 people in 1991. Murders reached an all-time high. How would you describe crime in America in that year, during 1991, when it peaked?
Well, it was a national crisis. It really was. And it was a very real crisis. I mean, people talk about the kind of the sensationalism around violence, and that's certainly a problem that's always been around. But at that time, from the 1970s all the way through the early 1990s, there was an actual crisis of violence in American cities. And that was a time when most cities around the country, particularly big cities, were extremely dangerous places. So this wasn't fabricated. This was the reality of urban America. And that was a point when, you know, a whole bunch of different sectors of society really mobilized to deal with violence. And that was a turning point. That was a point when violence started to fall. And that trend of falling violence is what I focus on in the book.
Why do you think the crime decreased, especially by so much?
Well, it started at that point when the nation, really crime came to be seen as a national crisis. And you can document this in, you know, several polls, most notably the Gallup poll, which has been asked since 1930, which asked Americans, you know, what's the most pressing problem facing the country? Well, in the first time in the history of that poll, violent crime was a top answer, and that happened in the early 1990s. So that signals something. That signals that this was seen as a national crisis. Politicians on both sides of the political spectrum started to campaign on confronting violent crime. And that led to this mobilization against violent crime. What I argue in the book is that that mobilization, which took several different forms, which I'll talk about in a second, that is the best explanation for why violent crime started to fall, when it did, and where it did. And so the forms that it took were, one, an expansion of police forces and a change in policing tactics. Secondly, the continuing increase in incarceration. Third, just a kind of sometimes ruthless but extremely aggressive effort to crack down on open-air drug markets and gang activity in central cities. And those are all kind of well-documented. There's another piece that I really focus on in the book. So in addition to all of those changes, there was also a mobilization among residents and local organizations that was designed to really take back their own communities and retake public sidewalks, public parks, playgrounds, retake alleyways, make sure that drug distribution wasn't going on in their neighborhood. So the mobilization that took place on the part of residents who were in the neighborhoods hit hardest by the crack epidemic, by the rise in violence that came along with it, that has been left out of discussions about why violence fell. But I think it's actually crucial, and the book documents the evidence for why I think that's the case.
Let's examine a few of those specifically. More police on the streets. This was something that state and federal governments were calling for, that there had to be more cops on the street. What happened?
Yeah, so this was a national call. You know, Bill Clinton ran on a platform of adding 100,000 police officers to the streets. And, you know, subsequently the 1994 crime bill was passed that added probably 60,000 or so officers to the streets. What we know from a good deal of evidence and very rigorous evidence is that more police on the street leads to less violent crime. Okay. I think the crucial question here is what police officers should be doing on the street. And that's the question that has generated more and more debate and more and more kind of controversy over time. But there's very little question at this point about that first order issue. Does more police on the street translate into less crime? And I think the answer is very clear now, if we're having an honest discussion, that relationship is very strong.
What about mass incarceration? Today, you say mass incarceration, and most people, or many people anyway, I should say, will be critical of it. And, of course, there are other reasons, the racial breakdown of the number of people who go to prison, the crimes that they committed or what they are arrested for, the reasons that they are behind bars. But you mentioned mass incarceration as a factor in why crime dropped.
Yeah, well, I think we should have two discussions here that are closely related but are not the same. One is, what does the evidence tell us in terms of the impact? And this is, you know, in regard to the conversation about mass incarceration, also in regard to the question about policing as well. So there's the empirical answer. What do we know about how incarceration has affected crime? And then there's the moral answer. What are the costs of this? How has this exacerbated racial inequality? Do we want to live in a society where, you know, we imprison a quarter of the world's imprisoned population? do we want that for our country? Okay, so I talk about both of those issues in the book, but if we just focus on the empirical question for a second, does incarceration affect crime? Then the answer is actually much less straightforward than the answer is for policing. I think for policing, we know that more police on the street reduces crime. For incarceration, it's much less clear. So there's some evidence that the increase in incarceration from the 1970s to the 1990s did have an impact on crime. The continuing increase in incarceration that occurred since then, where more and more people were wrapped up in the criminal justice system, more and more nonviolent offenders through mandatory minimum sentences and treating kids as adults in the criminal justice system, there's very little evidence that that was effective in continuing to reduce crime.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. Our guest during this portion of the program is Patrick Sharkey, author of the book Uneasy Peace, The Great Crime Decline, The Renewal of City Life, and The Next War on Violence. He will be appearing tonight at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. I want to move on to present day and some of the theories that you developed in the book as a result of the falling crime rate. In the book, you describe the impact that crime has had on several aspects of American life, especially in urban areas with high concentrations of African Americans. School performance, for example. Fascinating research that you cite into how students performed in school after there was a violent crime in their neighborhood. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, so this was some of the earliest research that really pushed me to take more seriously the idea that crime might be, or violence might be, you know, one of the most important things going on in very disadvantaged neighborhoods that seems to have such an impact on kids. So a couple of the initial studies that we did is we just looked at situations where kids were given assessments of cognitive skills or academic achievement tests. And by pure chance, some of the kids who were given these assessments were given them right before major incidents of violence had taken place near their homes, you know, so close by in their neighborhoods. Some of the kids in the same communities were given the same assessments just after local violence had taken place. Or in some cases, it was even more explicit. The same child was given an assessment before and after incidents of violence had taken place. And what I found, and this was in a series of successive studies, was that if a kid takes an assessment of cognitive skills just after there's been an incident of extreme violence, performance drops, not just to, you know, it's not just a noticeable impact. It's as if the child has missed about the last 2 years of schooling. That's the impact of just a single homicide. Okay. So if a child takes an assessment just in the days after a homicide occurs near the home, that child performs as if he or she has missed 2 years of schooling. Now, what this means is not that the child is less intelligent. What we found in successive studies is what's going on is that in the aftermath of violence, children are less able to focus. They're less able to concentrate. They're less able to maintain their attention on the task at hand. And that translates into a lower level of functioning. It translates into worse performance in school. And this is kind of a finding that is consistent with a whole bunch of literature on how we respond to stress. But the stress of violence is very unique, and it is incredibly damaging to kids. So this was kind of the first hint when I saw this evidence that violence may be the crucial mechanism here. And as I pushed it further, you know, what we found is that those impacts are not limited to school. Those impacts affect the stress response system. They affect how kids sleep. And those impacts are lasting over time. It makes kids ultimately have less success in school. And then we've taken it even into adulthood and found that when kids are in intensely violent neighborhoods or cities, they're less likely to experience economic mobility, to graduate from college, to move upward out of poverty.
And it only makes sense. You write about this in the book, but to paraphrase here, you write something like when a kid is worried about violence, They were frightened, maybe not consciously, but subconsciously, but probably consciously, when they're scared about walking outside the school doors, walking outside their home, that they're not concentrating on a standardized test. They're not concentrating on their classwork that day. Deep down, they're thinking about what's scaring them in the first place.
That's exactly right. And we now have better evidence on that than we've ever had before. And, you know, for audience members who have never lived in a really intensely violent environment, like myself, I've never lived in that kind of environment. The example that might make it a little bit more tangible is the one that I love to cite, because most readers remember this period. But there was a period in 2002 when there was a serial killer on the loose around D.C. Called the Beltway Sniper. And a lot of people will remember this period because it was a time of totally random violence. Well, what researchers have gone back and done is they've looked at how kids living in that area have performed on their academic, on statewide academic achievement tests in that period. And they found that kids who were nearby some of those shootings, which were completely random, when you look at their performance compared to kids who lived a little bit further away, otherwise were identical, but lived a little bit further away, their performance dropped sharply during that period. And so it's kind of just a reminder of what happens when there is violence around you. That becomes the focus of everyday life, getting through the day without being victimized, instead of, you know, getting through the day and trying to learn. So that's really the basis for a lot of the work that I talk about in the book, and a lot of what has convinced me that violence is really the central issue we should be thinking about, both for child policy, child development policy, and also for urban policy more generally.
You write about the Kerner Commission, something that was commissioned by President Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s that came as a result of a number of urban riots in some cities across the country. LBJ did not accept the findings of this report. He was at the time in a re-election campaign and didn't want to admit that there was racism across the country and that violence was a result of that. But what you do write, I want to jump ahead a little bit, is that the nation has traditionally or typically responded to violent crime with stricter punishment, minimum sentence laws, or more people going to jail. And you write that that probably is not the best way to go.
Yeah, so back in the 1960s, that was the decade when the issues that we've been dealing with since, the issues of urban inequality, urban poverty, were coming to the fore and were becoming increasingly visible. And at that point, you know, I'm glad you brought up the Kerner Commission, because it is kind of this moment in time when the nation is grappling with the question about how to deal with this growing problem of urban poverty and everything that comes with it, including violent crime. And the decision at that point to kind of ignore the conclusions of the Kerner Commission report and instead move toward a solution that relies on punishment, that relies on the police and the prison system to deal with the problems of urban poverty, that solution, which really kind of became solidified with the election of Richard Nixon and the subsequent policy implemented during that administration, but then has persisted since, has been reinforced through subsequent administrations, both Democrat and Republican. That approach has been consistent for the past 50 years. So when you talk about how to deal with the rise in violent crime, the immediate solutions that typically come to the fore focus on law enforcement. They focus on the criminal justice system, instead of focusing on the broader problem of what types of investments can be used to confront urban inequality, what types of investments can stabilize communities so that they don't wither away, so that they don't, the institutions don't start to crumble, so that they have a strong foundation, because those are the neighborhoods where violence never emerges. When a neighborhood has a strong institutional base, when there are strong religious institutions, schools, after school centers, health clinics, those communities don't wither away. Those communities, even if there is poverty, They are not places where violent crime emerges.
So when you talk about investment, you're talking about money from the federal or the state government that not focusing specifically on cracking down on crime or being tougher on crime, but investing in those neighborhoods, investing in those urban areas.
Yeah, I think at this point there's sufficient evidence. So this is not just, you know, my argument about how I think the world should work. I think there's now sufficient evidence to suggest that investments in core community institutions are probably the most effective way to control violence. Now, the police are central to this effort. Police play a fundamental role in controlling violence. But what I want to emphasize is that the police are not the only actors that can restore public order, that can be central in the effort to deal with violent crime. Police work most effectively if there is a strong institutional foundation, if they are not responsible for dealing with all the mental health problems in a community, okay, if they are not trying to make up for the low quality of schools or the absence of community centers, then police can be much more effective. You know, so I'm not saying we should ignore the police or we should get rid of the police. The police are a crucial part of stability in every urban community. What I'm saying is that there are a different set of actors. And those actors are residents, those actors are local organizations, religious institutions, after-school centers that have never had the same commitment. Okay, so what I argue for is a policy of investment in those types of institutions as the fundamental way to deal with the problem of violent crime moving forward.
You say that police should not just arrest people, but they should build relationships. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the job of law enforcement is not simply to enforce the law. The job is also to create relationships within a community, to create connections between resident institutions, to get people where they need to get the help that they need, and to build a stronger community. And there's a recognition of that that's growing across the country, where police departments are realizing that they are much more effective if they are working with residents to solve problems, if they are working with local organizations to solve problems, instead of taking on every social problem within a community on their own. So I think there's growing recognition of that. I think, you know, in New York City, there are very clear examples of this, where the police department is coming together with tenants organizations, local community groups, even other city agencies like the Department of Sanitation, to try to understand not just where crime is emerging, but where other problems are emerging in a community. Why is there a trash pileup outside a housing development? You know, what is to be done when the security lock in a public entranceway doesn't work in a development? These kinds of questions are just as crucial to dealing with the problem of violent crime as questions about where there's a spike in assaults. So the more that police departments recognize this, the more effective they can be. And I say that because there's evidence behind it, not just simply because it's the way that I think the world should work.
What's a community quarterback?
Community quarterback is an organization or institution that has as its mission the goal of looking out over the community and making sure all public spaces remain safe, all residents and visitors to the community are cared for, are looked after, and the community doesn't start to fall apart. Okay, and so, you know, there's been this idea of the importance of anchor institutions in communities for a long time. This is different. An anchor institution can be an organization that looks out over the community, but it doesn't have to be. You know, so the types of organizations that are particularly effective in controlling violence are the ones that don't just serve the people who walk through their doors, but that really look outward and try, where residents know they're going to be there for the long term. Residents know that if they need help, people in this organization are there for them. And so this is a very unique kind of organization, but I think it's crucial to the stability of a neighborhood. So one of the things that I argue for is to go through every community and to really take a census of, well, what organization or what group of people is really looking out over this community, making sure that it doesn't fall apart. And if you can't identify that organization or that group of people, then there's a good chance that that's a community that's vulnerable, okay, that is vulnerable to falling apart. That's a community where violence can emerge.
Earlier, I mentioned that there has been a rise in violent crime in the last 2 years in several cities. Why do you think that's happening?
Well, so there's been an increase from, I think, 2014 was the low point. It was actually one of the safest years in the history of the country. And then since then, in subsequent 2 years, there was an increase in violence. In the last 12 months, actually, violence has fallen. So I'm not sure that this trend has continued. The more updated data we get, the more it looks like this period of an increase in violence is probably over. That said, there was a meaningful increase in 2015 and 2016. What I think happened in cities across the country is that the old model of dealing with violence and dealing with it through aggressive policing, where police have kind of been asked to dominate public spaces, that model has broken down. And it broke down because there's more and more outrage about officer-involved shootings. There's more and more recognition, you know, as we all have videos, cameras on our cell phones, you know, the more and more interactions between police and residents came to the fore and became visible to a wider segment of the public. And the Black Lives Matter movement was extremely successful in mobilizing a large segment of the population to respond to this type of police officer violence. So as that old model started to break down, new models have started to emerge. But a lot of cities have struggled to figure out, well, okay, if we can't rely on the police to dominate public space, then what do we do? What's the next model? And some cities have adapted very well to that. Others have not.
Patrick Sharkey, author of Uneasy Peace, The Great Crime Decline, The Renewal of City Life, and The Next War on Violence. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Patrick Sharkey will appear at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg tonight at 7 p.m. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. It is WITF's spring fundraising campaign, and I'm joined by one of the nicest people I know, Tim Lambert, who is WITF's Multimedia News Director. Tim, good day to you.
Good day to you, sir. And thank you for the compliment. I appreciate it. And thank you for contributing and supporting WITF on this next to last day of our annual spring fundraising campaign. We have a goal of $1,500 for Smart Talk that we want to reach before 10 o'clock to stay on track to reach that overall goal by 6:30 p.m. tomorrow. And we are about $590 away from hitting that goal. That's just five $120 contributions to WITF.org or 1-800-233-9483, and we'd hit the goal. Hey, if you want to do a $5 a month contribution, $10 a month, a dollar a day contribution as an annual gift, that'd be awesome as well. Go to WITF.org or 1-800-233-9483.
Tim, last night I had the opportunity to go out to, actually in Hershey.
I thought we were going to talk about the playoffs and the Flyers and Penguins.
No, we're not going to talk about that today.
Continue.
Tim is a Penguins fan, I'm a Flyers fan, so we will not talk about that today. On this program, anyway.
We'll save this for outside.
That's right. Last night, I had the opportunity to moderate a debate of the Democratic candidates running in the 10th Congressional District. And the 10th Congressional District, of course, is a new district with Pennsylvania.
The old 4th, sort of, kind of.
Exactly.
Yes.
But a really good audience, good-sized audience in Hershey last night. And so many people came up to me and said, we love WITF. We love the programs. Love Morning to Edition, love Smart Talk, love the news, mentioning names, that's such a good thing to hear. Now, what I didn't say at the time was, if you love WITF,
make a contribution.
Well, that's right. We want to hear from you today. But we will say that to you today,
yes,
since we are in our spring fundraising campaign.
Yeah, and when you think about what journalism does, your daily life's affected by the actions of school boards, borough councils, county commissioners, state government, federal government, state agencies, federal agencies. They set policies, tax rates, regulations. Journalists then break that information down so you don't have to. You don't have to go read the law. You don't have to understand what the Sunshine Law is and what a borough council is doing or a school board is doing. We do that for you. We bring you the facts. We bring you the context each and every day. In this wide, wide world of, you know, of sports and of news, I guess, that, you know, all heck breaks loose on social media. So if you want a reliable source of news and information, we hope you'll support WITF financially now in the last 2 days of our fundraising campaign at 1-800-233-9483 or at WITF.org. It could be a $10 a month contribution, a $30 a month contribution, but make your contribution now.
Let's hear from you, Smart Talk listeners, 1-800-233-9483 or go to WITF.org/give now. Tim Lambert, thank you very much for being with us today.
You got it, Scott.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission is cracking down on people who haven't paid tolls over the years. So that's just one part of our conversation on tomorrow's show. On January 20th, 1942, 15 high-ranking Nazi Party and government leaders assembled to discuss the final solution to the Jewish question in Europe. The final solution was the Nazis' code name for the planned genocide of all European Jews. Ultimately, more than 6 million European Jews died. Today is Holocaust Remembrance Day. Appearing on today's Smart Talk is Lieutenant Colonel Ray Millen of the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. He'll discuss Germany's final solution. Pamela Weinberg is a local author and educator whose parents survived the Holocaust. She'll also be on Smart Talk. Also, violent crime has dramatically diminished over the last 30 years, even in cities that have a reputation of violence. In the newly released book, Uneasy Peace, The Great Crime Decline, The Renewal of City Life, and The Next War on Violence, author Patrick Sharkey delves into the reason violence in the country has dropped so much and if it will continue. Patrick Sharkey joins us on today's Smart Talk. Smart Talk comes up right after the news.